about an extremely high level. Yeah. So asakti, the word, like ruchi means taste, asakti means attachment. On the basis of the taste, which has arisen because of being so fixed. On the basis of the taste, the devotee is extremely attached to devotional activities and always being engaged in devotional activities. So after this, when the taste, when the ruchi for the activities of devotional service reaches extreme depth, and Krishna becomes the very object of one's devotional activities, what does that mean? Anyway, we'll come to that in a minute. One attains asakti. So the kripa, we mentioned the kripa of bhakti yesterday, the seed in Shraddha, and it gradually grows like that. So at this point, the kripa is bearing buds. So, oh, it mentions here, the buds become flowers in bhava and fruits on the level of prema. Very nice example. Very nice. So now there is a difference between ruchi and asakti. On the level of ruchi, obviously the devotee is attached. The devotee hears some kirtan, and the devotee's mind just becomes absorbed, and the devotee just loses sight of whether it's day or night or here or there or anything. Simply absorbed. So the devotee is certainly attached to Krishna and devotional service. But there is a difference. There's a difference in degree of attachment, and there's a reason for the difference of degree. And the essence of that is that Krishna is becoming the very object of one's devotional activities. So, let's just read what he says, and hopefully it'll be clear. The difference between ruchi and asakti is this. Ruchi has bhajan, or your devotional activities, as the subject, and asakti has the Lord, who is the object of bhajan, as the subject. So what that means. Anyway, I'll just read on another few sentences. The stage can be decided from the amount of each component. Actually, ruchi and asakti have both components. But by the intensity of one or the other, ruchi and asakti can be distinguished from each other. And the essence, in a sense, is now in the next sentence. Asakti polishes the mirror of the heart to such a condition that the Lord, reflection of the Lord, or the Lord, reflection means the Lord, suddenly seems to be visible there. So now, ruchi has bhajan as the subject, but asakti has the Lord as the subject. So this means that on the level of ruchi, the devotee is relishing the hearing and chanting, the serving, the associating, and all these things. The devotee is relishing the devotional activities. Now, why is the devotee relishing? Like when you chant Hare Krishna. Everyone chant?
Hare Krishna!
Okay, very good. We should do it more often. So, now what are we relishing? If we are relishing. Hopefully we're relishing. Or what are we doing? What are we tasting? Krishna. Why is it nice to chant Hare Krishna? Because Krishna is there. It's not just an energy. There's some energy there, and when you feel the energy, it feels good. No. Krishna is there. So when you chant Hare Krishna, Krishna's dancing on your tongue, and you taste Krishna. And Krishna tastes very nice. Now, depending on whether your tongue is diseased or not, as we were discussing, the taste will differ. If your tongue is still diseased, then you'll taste Krishna. When you chant Hare Krishna, you're tasting Krishna. But because your tongue is diseased, then you think, oh, bitter, bitter. But then you're chanting on and on, becoming purified, cleansed of the disease, on and on. So then it becomes okay. I can chant Krishna, yes, all right, Krishna, Hare Krishna, it's all right. And then you go on, you're in ruchi, and you're chanting, you're absorbed like that. Your tongue is now contacting Krishna, as it has been in the other stages also. But your tongue is now a little purified, so you're now tasting a sweetness. Oh, chanting Hare Krishna, so nice. So what is that? You're actually tasting Krishna as he is, because your tongue is now capable or becoming capable of tasting the real taste in the real way, rather than the bitter way because of the disease. So, ruchi means that you're getting so much taste from tasting Krishna, actually. And, just like you know the story, I've mentioned this many times, there's the picture of Krishna, little baby Krishna lying on the, I think, peepal tree leaf or some leaf or other, right? Sucking his tongue. Banyan, well, they're all banyan trees. So, someone asked Krishna, why are you sucking your tongue? I'm sure you've heard this before. Krishna said, well, my devotees keep talking about how sweet my lotus feet are. So I wanted to find out for myself. So I'm sucking my toe, and I can see that my toes are very sweet. So then he immediately put his toe back in his mouth and continued sucking. So actually, Krishna tastes sweet, actually. If you were to lick Krishna's body, as long as your tongue doesn't have the disease, material contamination, you will taste such a taste, literally, taste with your tongue. You will taste such a taste, you'll think, wow, this is astonishing. This is also why Bakasura, you know Bakasura, tried to swallow Krishna, but he couldn't, he spat him out, because he had the disease. So Krishna tasted foul. So he just spat him out. Oh, what a taste. He was actually tasting Krishna's body. In fact, so when you chant, your tongue is contacting Krishna's body. And depending on the degree of the disease you have, you will taste Krishna's body differently. And on the level of ruchi, you will taste it to be so nice that you'll just want to go on and on, and you'll become oblivious to everything else. So therefore, ruchi has bhajan as the subject. Bhajan meaning activities in which you are contacting Krishna and experiencing the taste of Krishna in different ways. In the prasad, in the discussion, in the kirtan, in the association, in the pictures, in the books, in everything like that. But now asakti has Krishna as the subject. So what does this mean? Well, it's inferred here on page 21, am I right? Yes. That asakti polishes the mirror of the heart to such a condition that the reflection of the Lord, which is not such a brilliant translation, other translations are better, they make it clear that the fact is that the devotee is actually perceiving Krishna. The devotee is not just a taste, that because Krishna is there and I'm tasting Krishna, even though I don't see him, but because he's there I taste something sweet. But the devotee is actually perceiving the cause of the sweet taste, which is Krishna, directly. So, asakti means that the devotee is getting there's a sense of the actual presence of Krishna, which is not hallucination, not mental concoction, but the devotee is actually beginning to perceive Krishna as being present and is extremely attached to that. So you follow the idea? Very interesting. And I mean, extremely high level. So then he goes on that the rest of this page 21 is basically the same thing which appeared in that last paragraph about ruchi, expressing the mind of such a person, but now he's expressing it in great detail, because the state of mind of the devotee on asakti is very extraordinary. All sorts of things are there. One very interesting thing, if you look in the second to last paragraph, sometimes wandering in the forest, absorbed in emotion, observing the movements of the animals and birds, he will intuitively interpret them as signs of mercy or punishment of Krishna upon himself. Because he's beginning to perceive Krishna actually being present, then he'll be looking, where is Krishna? Is Krishna here? Is Krishna there? Is Krishna doing this? Something is happening. Is Krishna doing this? Is my Lord's hand actually here? So if an animal, he says, if Krishna is showing his mercy to me, then the antelope in the distance will come towards me 3 or 4 steps. He's looking to see. And he's interpreting in that way. It may be true or it may be not. I mean, whether the antelope comes, whether that is an indication from Krishna or not, it may or may not be. But he's seeing it like that because he has this intense attachment which is just driving him towards Krishna. If he is not showing mercy, if Krishna is not showing mercy, the antelope will turn away. So he's looking, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna's hand? And where is he even in person? On the outskirts of a village, seeing a small Brahmin boy playing, reminding him of Sanaka Kumar, he'll inquire from him, will I see Vrijendra Kumar today? Will I see Krishna today? Now this, of course, could be any little boy. He just happens to be playing there. And now this devotee in this rather extraordinary state of mind is asking him some question which this boy never thought about. How does he know whether the devotee is going to see Krishna or not? So the boy may say anything. But the boy says no. The boy says no. So the devotee thinks, wow. Wow, what is this? This is a sign from Krishna. So in other words, it's sort of reminiscent of it's an otherworldly state of mind. And so, therefore, people may interpret this state of mind in negative ways. He's becoming so absorbed, like we said on the level of Ruchi, so absorbed that the world doesn't exist any longer. He's just absorbed in hearing and chanting. Doesn't matter if it's day or night or whatever's going on, he's just absorbed. But here now, he's so absorbed, so much more absorbed, that it's like, losing touch with reality, or so-called reality. So he goes on to say, let's see, the next last paragraph. When asked by his relatives what is the matter, he'll sometimes act like a mute, but at other times he'll act as if he's normal. His friends will apologize for him. Don't worry, recently he became a little scatterbrained. His neighbors will conclude that he's an idiot. The followers of Mimamsa, meaning like rigid Vedic philosophers, something like that, will think he's a fool. Those who study Vedanta, the spiritual philosophers, will think he's an illusion. He should be analyzing philosophy about the absolute truth. But he's wandering around asking people if he's going to see Krishna today. So they'll think he's an illusion. The Karmis, those who are practicing material piety, will think that he's on the wrong path. But the devotees will say he's attained the highest truth. Actually, he hasn't. There's still some stages to go, but practically speaking, he's attained the highest truth. So like this, the devotee, oblivious of respect or disrespect, having fallen into the current of the great celestial river of attachment to the Lord, will simply continue in the same manner. Now, of course, Prabhupada, who was on a higher level, didn't act like that. Sometimes he would a little bit, although you'd hardly notice, you'd have to look, and sometimes you might perceive that Prabhupada was sort of drifting off. Drifting away from so-called reality. So one point to bear in mind is that if a devotee who otherwise you might expect to be very advanced, that if they're not manifesting these rather like materially abnormal symptoms, then it doesn't mean that they're not on the level of a sati or bhava or whatever level it may be. The thing is that the uttama adhikari, who is acting as a preacher, by order, by the order of Rupa Goswami, has to act as an ordinary person. So even though sometimes it may be very difficult, still he'll try to act as an ordinary person. So Prabhupada generally acted as an ordinary person, in the sense that he was very down to earth, very clear-headed, and he was very organized like that. So that doesn't mean that he wasn't on this level, internally. So a devotee may be functioning on this level internally, but externally, because the devotee is acting as a preacher and is under order like this, then they may act as the most, as a very together person. So people would not think that he's on this very high and very emotional level of attachment for Krishna. So, in other words, it doesn't have to be as open and obvious as this, necessarily. Although this is like the essence of it, internally. Comments or questions? I know we're all getting onto levels which may be a little hard to relate to. And I hope, you know, we're making it clear now. Someone wants to ask someone? Which? Bharat Maharaj. No. He was on the level of Bhava. Yes. But he fell down. Because of his offences in the past. Now, in everyone on the level of Bhava, we understand that there'll be some effects of their offences from the past. But if you haven't committed very severe offences in the past, then the effects of them on the level of Bhava will not be very disturbing. But if you committed some bad offences in the past, very bad, then it is possible that the effects may really disturb your devotional service, even on the level of Bhava. So, I mean, we all know, we hear it so many times, and we'll say it again. We should be very, very careful of offences. Yeah, very, very careful. Because you may get over the immediate implications quickly. You may sort it out with the person, and the person says, okay, don't worry about it. So in a sense, it's done. But the after effects can linger on. They tend to linger on. Yeah. Okay, just don't drift off yet. That's a good question. How do you protect yourself from the tendency to commit offences? Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur makes a very nice suggestion. How to protect yourself from offending in Harinam Chintamani. He says that there are two things you can do. One is, you can just think that I mustn't commit offences and just be, you know, thinking regularly like that. I mustn't. Am I? You know, I must not. Like that. Being very attentive to not commit offences. Then he says there's another thing you can do which is even better. That instead of just thinking that I must not commit offence, I must not blaspheme this devotee, I must not disobey the order of my spiritual master. He says that you can positively do the opposite. Meaning, you can glorify the devotees. Whenever you meet a devotee, you glorify them. So automatically you're doing the opposite. You're automatically not blaspheming, but you're actually doing the positive. And you can be very anxious to know, what are the orders of my spiritual master? What can I do for him? Like this. So he recommends that you try and do the opposite, practically, rather than just try and come to like a zero point, that I'm not doing the offences. It's like a neutral point. But go on the positive side. Instead of thinking that I mustn't blaspheme the Vedic scriptures, think I must have a deep interest in understanding and following the Vedic scriptures and studying them and appreciating them, like that. So he says that this is a better way. You'll automatically avoid doing the offence. And actually, you'll be doing a very positive thing. So that's a suggestion from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur.
Some other comments or questions? Okay.
Srila Prabhupada.
Yes.
Becomes free of unwanted things, at least to a very great extent. So the bad habits, the attractions to material things, misunderstandings, wrong conceptions about what is the process of devotional service, all these things essentially are eliminated. So when they're eliminated to that extent, then naturally the devotee is very easily able to be very absorbed in devotional service all the time, always chanting without impediment from the mind, always attracted to engaging in devotional activities, always attracted to Krishna Katha, and no real attraction to anything else. So naturally on such a level of devotional service, the devotee is very blissful, and the devotee is fixed in Krishna consciousness. So this is a very nice level, actually. Problems are gone. Essentially, problems are gone. None of us, of course, enjoy problems. And to some extent, I'm sure we've taken to Krishna consciousness, at least with some idea that it'll help me to get out of my problems. That is a common motivation, at least one type of common motivation for people to take up Krishna consciousness. So we should understand that the way to get to that point where we're always happy, very, very happy, and there are really no problems of any great significance, that is to come to this point of being steady in Krishna consciousness, free from anarthas. So the devotee then who's so absorbed, always engaged in devotional activities, with the mind, generally at least, always remembering Krishna, then because Krishna consciousness is so sweet, it's blissful, being transcendental. By nature, Krishna consciousness is blissful. So when the devotee is always fixed in Krishna consciousness, the devotee is always blissful. And the devotee is tasting a very wonderful taste of pleasure in all these devotional activities. Then the devotee, being absorbed in devotional service, with this taste becoming more and more absorbed, then the devotee becomes more and more attached to Krishna. We were making the point yesterday that the devotee on that level is on the level of asakti now, is beginning to perceive Krishna, whereas on the level of ruchi, the devotee is enjoying the devotional activities so much. This is ruchi, that enjoyment of the devotional activities. What is that enjoyment? That is the contact of the senses and the mind with Krishna. But on the level of ruchi, the fact that one's senses and mind are actually contacting Krishna in person is not so apparent. But on the level of asakti, one begins to see Krishna, actually. In this way, he was making the distinction between ruchi and asakti, that in ruchi, bhajan is the subject, or devotional activities. And in asakti, Krishna, who is the subject of the bhajan, or object or whatever. Object, is it? Okay. Krishna himself becomes the subject. Within the bhajan, it's just like a deeper perception of what is the bhajan, or what are the devotional activities. There was one particularly interesting point that I unfortunately skipped over yesterday. Where is it? It's in chapter 6, and all I have to do is find it. Anyway, the basic point is that It's about how he withdraws, how his mind becomes withdrawn from material things. Where am I? Of course I don't have it, do I? That's wonderful. Anyway. Yeah, I don't have page 21. Or maybe I do. 11, 12, 17. Okay, anyway, you get the idea. It's there. Thanks. Page 21, right, second paragraph. So, in the stage previous to Asakti, the devotee, on realizing his mind has been overpowered by material objects and desires, by his deliberate effort, almost withdraws his mind and almost fixes it. Anyway, I don't know if that's a correct translation, but the devotee definitely, by deliberate effort, withdraws the mind and fixes it on Krishna, actually. But at the appearance of Asakti, absorption of the mind in the Lord is automatic. Without having to make an effort, it happens. Without effort. A devotee at the stage of Nishta cannot detect how and when his mind withdraws from topics of the Lord's qualities, forms, etc., and fixes itself on material affairs. So, we don't want to give a contradictory picture of what Nishta is. On the level of Nishta, definitely the devotee is basically fixed. But there are some contaminations still there. Generally, they're not an obstacle. But because they're there, sometimes they are. But it's not like on the level of Anatha Nivritti, where practically step by step one has been confronted with problems. So sometimes on the level of Nishta even, because there are existing some contaminations still. So sometimes the devotee's mind withdraws from Krishna consciousness and the devotee finds that, oh, now I'm thinking of something material. And then by some deliberate effort, he has to make the effort to withdraw the mind and bring it back to Krishna. So he can do it, actually. On the level of Anatha Nivritti, a devotee, a person, may go for days meditating on sense gratification and thinking, well, I shouldn't, but, you know, and then the mind goes back to sense gratification. Then half an hour later, the devotee may think, well, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this, should I? But then the mind goes back. So it may go on, it may be quite a thing. On the level of Nishta, is really not happening very much. Essentially, the devotee is fixed, but because some contamination is there, sometimes some material attachment may arise. On the level of Ruchi, actually the idea is that the devotee can quite easily withdraw the mind. And the idea is, regarding Asakti, that the devotee doesn't even have to make an effort to withdraw the mind. If somehow one is exposed to some material thing, and the mind being like a machine, basically, doesn't really have much discrimination. If it perceives something, it thinks about it. And then our intelligence may say, no, don't think about it. So if the mind perceives something, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the mind of the yogi is like an ocean, that things flow into the ocean, but they have no effect. Rivers flow into the ocean, but they don't affect the ocean. So in this way, things may flow into the yogi's mind, but they don't stay there. They just flow on out. So it's not that the devotee is not aware that there is a world around. So the devotee may see things and they make an impression. Now on lower levels, when those things make the impression, the mind gets attached. Oh yes, what about that? Sense gratification. On the level of Asakti, the impression may be there. One is exposed to some material influence. So some impression is there. But the mind immediately just goes back to Krishna. You get the idea? Thank you. Thank you. So, Asakti. Asakti is a very high level of pure devotional service. and the devotee is developing what something which you could call from the material point of view something like an obsession with Krishna. Something like that. It's like an unrelenting interest in Krishna, Krishna's service, chanting Krishna's name, like a